You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
So let's come back to our motivation. So we all want to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. But we often have the mistaken notion that happiness means that everybody treats us nicely, that we get what we want, that our body is comfortable, that we're respected and appreciated and loved. And we think that all of that is happiness. However, if we look in our own experience, there have been times in our life when we have had all of that, and we've been very unhappy at the same time. We can be in a beautiful place with people we care about, our body very comfortable, everybody liking us, and still inside there's rumination, there's doubt, there's depression, there's anger. So if we simply look at our own experience, we see that actually happiness does not come from the external environment. Rather, happiness depends a lot on what our attitude is. If we have a heart of kindness, a heart of gratitude and appreciation for others, then we can be content and happy no matter who we're with. Whereas if we have a judgmental, self-centered, angry mind, then we will be unhappy no matter who we're with. So things really depend on our perspective, our attitude, our interpretation. So our happiness is our responsibility, and our misery is also our responsibility. We have to stop going through life putting the responsibility for our happiness and misery on external people and see that we're the ones who create the cause for our happiness and misery. So let's have a determination to do this. And part of creating the cause of happiness for ourselves is learning to have compassion for other living beings. Caring about what happens to them, wishing them well, and wishing them to be free of this cycle of constantly recurring problems of samsara. So with that kind of attitude towards others, let's strive to purify our own mind, cultivate our good qualities, attain full awakening, so that not only can we be happy, but we will have no limitations in contributing to the happiness of all beings. So in order to do that, we need to listen to teachings, and that's why we're here this evening. learning to be responsible for our own happiness and misery is quite a responsibility, because we have the habit of blaming everybody else when we're unhappy. Don't we? Yeah, if I'm unhappy, it's because you criticize me, you blame me for things I didn't do, you don't appreciate me, you think I'm stupid, and on and on and on. You know, I'm unhappy because you. As soon as we say that, we're making ourselves powerless to deal with our own situation. Because if it's the other person's responsibility, then there's nothing I can do to change it. Except nag and pester and get angry at the other person until they change. Now, when we nag and pester and get angry at other people, are they usually accommodating and will they do what we want? Hardly. Yeah. So that strategy that we've been using since beginningless time to get happiness basically backfires. Yeah. And they won't do what we want them to do. And then we get more upset, and more entrenched, and more adamant, and blame them more. Punch them in the nose, and we think at that point they're going to say, oh yes, of course, I'll do what you want. Yeah. How many times has that happened? Yeah. Or maybe once in a while we can succeed in coercing somebody else into doing what we want, but then they pay us back later on. Yeah. And sabotage something we're doing because they don't like being coerced or manipulated. So, you know, when we're unhappy, then we have to stop and look at our own mind. And this is our practice. How do I make my mind happy? Because if I'm unhappy with the way somebody treated me, it's usually because I'm attached to something. I'm clinging to something. Yeah. And attachments are a setup for disappointment. Aren't they? Yeah. Even small attachments. I come in, oh, I hope tomorrow they're going to make spaghetti for lunch. Well, what's the chance of that? Yeah? Then even they make spaghetti for lunch, they didn't make the tomato sauce right. Yeah. I like the tomato sauce this way, not the way they made it. Yeah, so at a certain point, you know, it gets really difficult trying to control everybody. And at a certain point, we just say, okay, maybe I better look to change my own mind instead of wanting to control everybody else and make them be different. What do you think? Yes, yes, it's true. But you don't understand what this person did to me. The only way it's ever going to work. Say, this is a result of my previously created actions. I have to bear the result now. No use getting angry and frustrated. Yeah? Or, gee, I don't like people acting this way towards me. Do I ever act that way towards them? criticize anybody. Well, yeah. You know? So to work on our own faults. Yeah. Because they're the only faults we can do anything about. Okay. So, we'll go back to the Nagarjuna's text of Precious Garland. Yeah, and we're on chapter one. In the first part of the chapter, he talked about the creating the causes and conditions for upper rebirth, which relate very much to what we were just talking about. You know, the fact that we create the causes for our own experience. And so to put some time and energy into doing that. And then the second part of the chapter that we're in the middle of now is creating the causes for awakening, for liberation and awakening. And so here, you know, the principal cause is the wisdom realizing the ultimate nature, the wisdom realizing the lack of true existence of persons and phenomena. And so he's been describing that to us, remember? And not falling to the two extremes, the extreme of existence or eternalism, absolutism, where we reify things and think they have their own nature that's independent of everything else. And the opposite extreme of nihilism, where we discount things that actually exist and think they don't exist at all. Okay, the nihilist, of those two extremes, the nihilistic one is the most dangerous. Because if we dismiss the functioning of actions and their effects and say that, you know, our actions have no ethical dimension, that there's no result of our actions, that kind of nihilistic view opens us up to just act any old way we want to, thinking that we won't experience the result of our actions. And that's a real big wrong view, because then we do all sorts of things and we wind up experiencing the painful sufferings of them. Yeah. So that's why nihilism is the worst of those two. Most of us start out at, we're at the extreme of absolutism, thinking that things have some kind of inherent nature. Such as, for example, there's a real me. You know, it's a real me. Do you feel like you're a real you? Yeah. There's a real me, and this is who I am. Yeah, that's one of our biggest wrong views. Okay, so we're on verse 57. And actually here he's going to be talking about the results of having either a nihilistic or absolutist wrong view, okay? So he says the nihilist goes to a low rebirth. The essentialist, that's somebody who has the extreme of absolutism, the essentialist attains higher rebirth. But through knowing reality just as it is, not relying on the two extremes, one is liberated. Okay, so if we're a nihilist, yeah, we wind up, like I said before, thinking there's no ethical dimension to our actions, so we do any old thing, we steal, we lie, we sleep around, we criticize people, and then we wind up experiencing the result of those negative actions. For example, having an unfortunate rebirth. Okay. The essentialist, the absolutist who thinks that things have their own nature, they believe in karma and its effects, even though they don't have the correct view of how karma and its effects exist, the mode of existence. But they still have respect for karma and its effects, so they try and abandon destructive actions and cultivate good actions. Because of that, even though they're nihilist, because they keep good ethical conduct, then they'll have a fortunate rebirth.
Essentialists, you said nihilists.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, so the essentialists, yeah, keep good ethical conduct, so they will have a fortunate rebirth, okay? But then, Nagarjuna says, well, yeah, you can keep going, lower rebirth, higher rebirth, lower rebirth, higher rebirth, going up and down on the merry-go-round, or you can try and get off the merry-go-round. So he says, through knowing reality just as it is, not relying on the two extremes, one is liberated. So when we have the correct view, seeing that although things lack their own essential nature, they're empty of having some essential independent nature, still they exist by being designated by name and concept. Yeah. And so saying that they're empty of inherent existence, that person avoids the extreme of absolutism by saying that phenomena still exist, only nominally, then they avoid the extreme of nihilism. And through that middle way view, then they're able to attain liberation because they're able to meditate on that view and see that, for example, there's no inherently existent person, but there is a person who it creates karma and is born, a person who is in samsara who attains nirvana. So the middle way view, they're able to deny inherent or true existence and yet still establish conventional or nominal existence. Okay. So the person who, in that way we can establish the existence of the three jewels of rebirth, of karma and its effects, and still see that they lack any kind of true or independent existence. Now, some people misunderstand one of the lines in this verse, not relying on the two, okay? They misunderstand that, okay? And instead of understanding that the two extremes that are here called existence and non-existence actually mean absolutism and nihilism. Instead, they take the words literally and they think that all phenomena are neither existent nor non-existent. Okay? So, that doesn't make much sense, does it? Because if something's not existent, it's got to be non-existent. And if something is not non-existent, it's got to be existent. But they get confused and say, well, things are neither existent nor non-existent. They are inexpressible. Yeah. So that kind of view just leaves people, drowning in confusion. And they're paralyzed. They can't act one way or another because they can't establish anything. Everything's kind of mush in their mind. Okay? So, what they're pointing out here is that when we read, some of the verses of either the sutras or the great Indian commentators, we have to make sure we understand those verses correctly. Because it's easy to misunderstand them and then create a lot of wrong views and dig ourselves into a ditch. Okay? verse 58. So Nagarjuna says, asserting neither existence nor non-existence by knowing reality just as it is, if you think such wise persons are thereby nihilists, why wouldn't you also be essentialists? Okay, so the non-Buddhists, what does this mean, yeah? So the non-Buddhists and the proponents of the lower Buddhist tenet systems, they believe that the example of the mirage that we talked about before, yeah, that shows that nothing inherently exists, and therefore things don't exist at all. Yeah, in other words, there's, you know, they can't see the reflection of the mirror as just a reflection. You know, there's no face, then there's nothing at all. So they say, okay, things aren't inherently existent, then they don't exist at all. Okay, and so because they have this wrong view, yeah, so they're holding on to inherent existence, and they're saying, if things don't inherently exist, the only other choice is that they're totally non-existent. Yeah. What Nagarjuna is saying is there is another choice. If they're not inherently existent and they're empty of inherent existence, they can still exist nominally. But these people don't understand that. They go to the other extreme of nihilism. You know, if it's not inherently existent, it doesn't exist at all. Okay? And so, therefore, they accuse Nagarjuna of being a nihilist. Yeah, Nagarjuna, you negate inherent existence. That means you think everything's non-existent. Everything is just totally, you know, there's no people out there. There's no me. Everything is totally non-existent. You're a nihilist. Okay? So throughout the ages, you know, the lower tenet systems have been accusing the Madhyamakas, and within the Madhyamakas, the Prasangikas, of negating too much and therefore being nihilists. Okay? In response to this, Nagarjuna uses an identity, a very similar kind of reasoning. And he says, if you say that our assertion that phenomena aren't inherently existent makes us nihilists, then by your asserting that everything exists inherently, wouldn't you fall to the extreme of absolutism and thereby be an essentialist? Yeah? You see what he's doing? You're saying, okay, you know, because, you know, we're saying things aren't inherently existent, so that makes us a nihilist. So if you're saying things are inherently existent, that should make you an essentialist. But these people don't like that because they think their view is the middle way view. They have their own definition of essentialism and nihilism. All the, you know, the Buddhist tenet systems, they all claim to have the middle way view, but they all describe the extreme of absolutism and the extreme of nihilism differently. So Nagarjuna is saying, oh, you think we're a nihilist? Well, if you believe the opposite of what we're saying, then you should be an essentialist. And they go, no, we're not an essentialist. We have the correct middle way view. Okay. But he says, you know, if you're giving that argument to me, I'm giving it right back to you. Okay, so the point of his doing this is to show them that negating inherent existence doesn't make somebody a nihilist. Okay, and asserting the conventional existence of the three jewels, the law of cause and effect, rebirth, and these things, saying that those things exist, that doesn't make somebody an essentialist. Okay? So he's saying to these people, you know, you have the wrong view of the two extremes and the wrong view of the middle way here, okay? Because according to Nagarjuna, you can negate inherent existence say that things don't have some independent, separate essence of their own, and say they're empty of that, and still establish that they exist on the nominal level without having some essence that makes them them. Okay? So phenomena exist conventionally by being merely designated, and at the same time, they are empty of inherent existence. Okay? Then, verse 59. If the refutation of existence were to entail nihilism by implication, then why isn't absolutism entailed by the refutation of non-existence? Okay, so but when he says if refutation of existence, he means inherent existence. If that were to entail being nihilistic, yeah, then why isn't absolutism entailed by the refutation of non-existence, meaning total non-existence? Okay, in other words, if you refute inherent existence and say therefore somebody must be non-existent, therefore somebody's nihilist, then when somebody refutes total non-existence, shouldn't they also be an absolutist? So this is the same argument from two verses ago. Okay? You just have to understand here that when he says existence, it means inherent existence, and non-existence means total non-existence. It doesn't mean emptiness. Okay? So, according to Nagarjuna's system, asserting that things don't inherently exist is not nihilism, and saying that they're conventionally existent is not absolutism. So do you see how many times in this text he makes this point again and again and again? Yeah? And do you remember when we did the 400 with Aryadevit? He made this point again and again and again. Okay, so there's a reason for it. Yeah? So, even though phenomena don't exist with their own independent essence, still the Prasangika Madhyamikas can present the entire system of agent, object, and action, the entire system of cause and effect, you know, and present them all as existing conventionally without any contradiction, even while saying that none of these things have their own independent essence. Okay? So by accusing Nagarjuna of being a nihilist, all these non-Buddhists and proponents of lower Buddhist systems have misunderstood emptiness and the actual meaning of the middle way. That's what he's getting at here. Okay? So, apprehending the world as existent means apprehending it as inherent existent. That's what this is talking about in this verse. And that's ignorant. Yeah. Similarly, apprehending the world as non-existent means apprehending it as totally non-existent. That's also ignorant. Okay? So, however, according to the Svatantrikism below, all the lower systems, when inherent existence is refuted, all existence is refuted, and when and total non-existence is established. And so that's why they say that Prasangikas are nihilists, but that's because they don't understand things correctly. Okay? So again and again, making the same point. Yeah? But we can see, you know, when we start analyzing things, you know, we've done this in class, when we start analyzing things and we get to the point of they're empty, something in our mind says, no, 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 they've got to have something there. If there's nothing there, then they don't exist at all. So we begin to see from our own experience how it's actually quite easy, you know, to zigzag back and forth between these two extremes, because our mind wants to clutch at something. Okay. So here in the commentary, again, Kensa Jumpa Tekcho mentions, you know, that view of things are neither existent nor non-existent, you know, wishy-washy and mush incorporated. Yeah. And so he wants to make the point here, what I said before about if you want to establish something, it's good to have a scriptural quotation, but you have to make sure you understand the scriptural quotation properly. So he gives an example here from the Sutra Unraveling the Thought. Heard of that sutra? Okay. Because that sutra says that conventional truth and ultimate truth are neither the same nor different. And that if you cling to the thought of same and different, you are mistaken because things are beyond being same or different. That sounds like a bunch of hocus pocus, doesn't it? Yeah? Because we think, what are they saying? That they're neither same? If you think that they're neither same nor different, you know, and that if you cling to the thought of same and different, you're mistaken. But look, things have either got to be the same or they've got to be different. There's no other choice. So what's he doing? Saying that I'm mistaken. Yeah? You know, you look at the sutra and say, what are they talking about? Things have got to be the same or they've got to be different. They can't be both. They can't be neither. You know? Okay? So we build up all sorts of funny ideas. Okay? So if we take this statement literally, someone could actually misconstrue it to mean, well, if things are neither same nor different, then there's got to be a third possibility. Yeah, can you think of a third possibility? Yeah? Difficult, okay. So that would be like somebody thinking there's a third possibility. If you say, well, things are neither existent and nor non-existent. Well, oh, then there must be some other possibility, like both or neither, you know? Okay? So to explain the correct meaning of that quotation about the two truths, yeah, when the sutra says that they are not different, it means that the two truths are not different natures. They're one nature in the sense that you can't that a conventional truth and its ultimate nature always come together. You can't have one without the other. So in that way, they're the same. Okay? They can't be separated from each other. But when it, so that's the meaning of saying that they're not different. Okay? When it says that the two truths are not the same, it means that they do not have the same isolate, which is some philosophical term. I won't get into that. But it means that they're nominally different. Okay? So in this sense, a conventional truth and an ultimate truth, you know, they're also not the same because they have two different names. You know, you have the tissue packet and the emptiness of the tissue packet, and those two come together because as soon as you have the tissue, the ultimate nature of the tissue also exists. So the tissue and the emptiness of inherent existence of the tissue are both present at the same time. Okay? So in that way, they're not different. But they're also not the same because the tissue is not the emptiness of the tissue. Yeah, the tissue is the conventional thing that you blow your nose with. The emptiness of the tissue is its nature, and you can't blow your nose on the emptiness of the tissue. Okay? So they're not the same. And they're also not different. But that's the meaning of that quotation of saying that the two truths are neither the same nor different. Okay? That they're not different. They're not different natures, but they aren't the same isolate. They aren't nominally the same. So that's the meaning of that quotation, yeah? So that's why, you know, on this thing, when he's saying it's not existent and not non-existent, again, we have to understand what he's saying correctly, you know, or else we think that, you know, there's some other thing that they, you know, they're both existent and non-existent. Yeah? Do you both exist and non-exist? And that's foolishness, isn't it? Yeah, that doesn't happen. Okay, verse 60. So, Madhyamakas do not actually assert nihilism, nor behave nihilistically. And because they rely on awakening, they do not think as nihilists. So how can they be called nihilists? So here it has Madhyamakas. I'm thinking of changing that to Prasangikas. Okay, so Prasangikas do not actually assert nihilism, nor behave nihilistically, and because they rely on awakening, liberation, they do not think as nihilists, so how can they be called nihilists? Okay. So this verse is about realizing that freedom from the elaborations of inherent existence is not nihilism. Okay, so some of these verses in the Precious Scarlet, they imply like a dialogue. Yeah? So, you know, this is unpacked in Gyaltsebje's commentary, but it's kind of like Nagarjuna is talking to some people. You know, people are saying, oh, well, Nagarjuna, you said this, you know, this is wrong because of da 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 da. And then Nagarjuna writes this verse with his view in it. Yeah. So in the commentary, they point out, oh, you know, here's the thing that someone's thinking or saying, and then the verse is this reply. Do you remember in the 400? Yeah, there was always, you know, it always someone says. Yeah. So the Tibetan first someone says is ka cheek, in other words, one mouth. Yeah. So we used to call him Job Low. We were more polite than calling him one mouth. But, you know, but Joe Blow kind of comes in here and, you know, says something, okay? So here, Joe Blow says, okay, wait a minute. So yeah, so here Joe Blow actually is some of those who follow the hearer vehicle, so they're Buddhists, yeah? And so, but they belong to the lower tenant systems. So they think that karma and its effects exist inherently. Okay. So they misunderstand the Prasangika's negation of inherent existence and think that instead they're denying the effect of karma and its effects altogether and thus thinking they're nihilistic. Okay, so same kind of thing, yeah. So here, Joe Blow, so these people from the hearer vehicle, they say, well, although you don't say that you deny the existence of karma and its effects through your verbal and physical behavior, it seems like you do. Okay. So to this, the Prasangikas say, well, while we assert that phenomena such as the law of karma and its effects are not inherently existent, we never say that they're totally non-existent. So we don't fall to any extreme. So we stop all of our faulty behavior. Yeah, we don't fall to that extreme of nihilism and think, oh, there's no good, there's no bad, I can do whatever I want. Okay, so we've stopped all faulty behavior, so our physical conduct and our speech are not like the physical conduct and speech of the nihilists. Yeah, because the nihilists in ancient India, there was one school that, you know, just proclaimed that they were a nihilistic school. They were called the Charvakas, or it was translated as the hedonists. Yeah, because they said, well, you know, there's no result to what I do, so I'm hedonistically going to live it up and get all the pleasure I can, and who cares what I have to do to other people, because, you know, it's not going to bring any bad results on me. Okay? So, you know, the prasangikas are accused now of being like that, and they're saying, sorry, you know, we're not nihilistic, and we believe in cause and effect, and, you know, our behavior is okay. So they say that back to Joglo. So then Joglo alters his accusation a little bit, and this time he says, well, you don't speak or act like nihilists because you're worried about not receiving as many offerings and as much respect. So to prevent that from happening, you make sure that your outer behavior doesn't accord with that of nihilists, but inside, you're still thinking there's no cause and effect. Okay, so somebody's now making that accusation. So then Nagarjuna, the prasangikas, reply, actually, we have perfectly realized the path to awakening, and we've understood karma and its effects correctly, and we don't deny their existence. Yeah, so we're not nihilists at all, and our behavior isn't the behavior of nihilists. We're very respectful of the law of cause and effect, and, you know, are very aware of the subtleties of dependent arising, so we keep very good ethical conduct. That's what Nagarjuna is saying here. Okay? So this whole thing, the point here is that this assertion of things being empty of inherent existence, yet still existing nominally, this is a unique quality of the prasangikas. Yeah, that's not held by any of the other schools. Okay, now, we're going to do verse 61 and 62 together. So, verse 61 says, ask the worldly philosophers, the Samkhyas, the Vaisheshikas, and the Jains, who assert the real existence of the person and aggregates, whether they maintain that the interdependent is beyond existence and non-existence. Realize, therefore, that the nectar of the Buddha's teachings, which is beyond all notions of existence and non-existence, and which is called the profound, is our unique Dharma heritage. Quite beautiful. Okay, so the point in these two verses is only the Buddha spoke of the freedom of the two extremes. All the other schools, non-Buddhist, Buddhist, they all, in one way or another, go to one of the two extremes to some degree or another. Okay, so here, what Nagarjuna is saying is to know if this assertion that things are empty of true existence and yet exist nominally, to know if that's the unique quality of the prasangikas, then ask any non-Buddhist philosophers or any proponent of the lower Buddhist tenet systems if they have this quality, if they have this kind of assertion. And all of them will respond that they don't. Okay? So the Samkhyas, and here Nagarjuna is going to talk a little bit very briefly just about these other schools and showing how they don't have this unique middle way view that the prasangikas have. Okay, so the Samkhyas, they were followers of one master called Kapila, and they were a prominent non-Buddhist school in ancient India. As were the Vaisheshikas, who were followers of Kanada, yeah, the Nyayanikas, who were associated with them, and the Jains, or the Nigranthas, or unclad ones. Yeah, they used to go around making. Okay, so all of these people assert that persons and phenomena substantially exist, and they don't understand the profound phenomena of the emptiness of inherent existence. And if you discuss with them, you'll find out for yourself that they don't talk about this unique quality that the prasangikas have. Okay? Because they all are all, in one way or another, asserting substantial existence. You know? They're saying either there was an external being who was a creator, or there is some kind of inherently existent cosmic substance, and everything came out of that, or some inherently existent cosmic mind, and everything came out of that. You know, all different kinds of assertions. They have their own kind of detailed and complicated philosophies. Okay? So when we, you know, really talk with these people, then you listen to their assertions, then you see, oh, they don't come anywhere near the middle way view of the Prasangika Madhyamakas. Okay? And in the process of doing that, then you begin to see how precious this middle way view actually is, and how delicate it is to actually get that, where you can refute exactly what doesn't exist and establish exactly what does exist without falling to one extreme or the other. It's quite difficult, they say. Yeah. So seeing that it's very precious, we should put our efforts to becoming learned in it and leave far behind all ideas of true or inherent existence. Yeah. Such as saying, for example, that there's a permanent, unitary, independent person or soul, you know, behind all ideas of some kind of soul or self that is separate from the body and mind. Yeah, leave behind all kind of ideas that there's some truly existent, tiniest particle that's the building blocks for all phenomena. Yeah, this is touching on what physics is discovering. Okay. Leave behind all assertions of some kind of cosmic substance out of which everything appears. Yeah, so all thoughts of substantial existence. And, you know, and you leave that behind because you see that this view of the middle way is really very, you know, to get to it exactly is very delicate, you know, and that you need to be diligent, and therefore it's quite a precious thing, because only when you get this view exactly can you attain liberation. If you go even in the slightest bit to the extreme of nihilism or absolutism, then no liberation. Yeah, you have to hit the bullseye on this one, okay? So nirvana, the nectar of immortality, is beyond birth, aging, sickness, and death. Yeah, and the Buddhist teachings on nirvana are unrivaled. Okay, so the path for attaining it, the Arya path, the true paths, that are the fourth of the four noble, four truths for Aryas. Yeah, then those true paths are very special. And that the referent object, or the conceived object of the true path, the referent object of the true path. So the referent or apprehended object of the true path, which is the emptiness of inherent existence, is profound, is free of the two extremes of existence and non-existence. And that is our unique Buddhist heritage that the Buddha set forth with compassion. Yeah. And when you really think about, you know, okay, why am I suffering? Well, due to afflictions and karma. Where do afflictions and karma come from? From ignorance, you know, what do I have to do to eliminate ignorance? Well, I have to prove to myself that what ignorance thinks exists does not exist. So ignorance thinks inherent existence exists. I have to prove to myself that there's no such inherently existent things anywhere. Okay? And so that is my ticket out of samsara, and that's why finding this middle way view is really important. So then when you see that, then our veneration, our reverence for the three jewels really increases exponentially, because we see that without relying on the three jewels, there's no way we could even begin to understand the correct view ourselves. Yeah. I mean, if the correct view were easy to understand, we've been in samsara for beginningless time, why haven't we understood it? Yeah, if we can come to the correct view ourselves, we've had beginningless lifetimes to do it, why haven't we done it? You know? So we need to rely on guides. It's not something we can figure out ourselves. And so then, like I said, our reverence for the three jewels really increases, because we see that, you know, what the Buddha taught is like amazingly precious, more precious than all the wealth in the world, more precious than our loved ones and dear ones, more precious than all the fame and importance, you know. That really getting this correct view is the most worthwhile things in our lives. Okay. So any questions so far?
Say that when we come to this point each time, I can see the value of it, etc., but then I fall back on how can I do it? You know, I keep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you get to the point of seeing, oh, this is a very precious, unique heritage from the Buddha, but how can I ever realize it? Well, why can't you realize it? If the Buddha was once an ignorant being in samsara, and realized it, why can't you?
Get that up here, but not down here.
Well, you have to get it down here. Yeah. But I mean, just reason with yourself and really, you know, put it to that self-deprecating idea. You know, oh, I'm so special. Everybody else has the Buddha nature. I'm the only one who doesn't have it. Why did I miss out on getting the Buddha nature? Yeah. Then you have to say, oh, well, God must have created me without the Buddha nature. Oh, so you believe in God? Really? Otherwise, how is it that you're the only one who didn't have any Buddha nature? Yeah?
Just kind of in line with the comment, I kind of even don't go to the place of, I missed out. I keep thinking, well, the Buddha was special.
The Buddha was special, and I'm not special. So the Buddha was some lousy, miserable, sentient being, you know, going up and down in samsara for eons. But again, somehow he was special, and he had that Buddha nature that you just didn't get. You know? If we look at what we believe sometimes, I mean, you have to laugh like you're laughing right now, don't you? Because what we believe is ridiculous. Yeah? And you can see how it's all about me, isn't it? I'm the only one who doesn't have Buddha nature. Everybody else can become a Buddha, but I'm inferior. All about me. Isn't it? You know, this self-deprecating view is just like so self-centered. It's beyond belief. Isn't it? Yeah? I'm the only one who can make everything go wrong. I'm inferior to everybody. I'm more confused than everybody else. You know? It's the same old stupid self-centered drama. And it's ridiculous. We gotta throw that out. Either that, or, you know, you put that on the debate ground and give a good syllogism for proving why you're the only one who can't do it. Yeah, what's the syllogism? Because I'm flazy?
Lazy.
Yes. Was that a between flaky and lazy?
I was
going to
go stupid, but I think lazy's more honest.
Oh, because you're lazy. Okay. So that means that if you are lazy, forever you cannot become a Buddha. So then you have to make that. I can never, you know, someone who is lazy can never become a Buddha. Never, ever, ever become a Buddha. Because?
Because I'm inherently lazy
and never change. Yes, then you go into your refutation of inherent existence, don't you? Is lazy some permanent quality that is the essence of who you are? You're nodding your head, yes?
Seems like sometimes.
Are you always discouraged?
You either are totally stupid and in a snap of fingers become a Buddha. Yeah, there's no process for practicing. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you're either an infant or you're 90 years old. There's no process of aging. What are you now then, dear? You don't look like an infant, and you don't look like you're 90 years old either. Yeah. Okay. So we have to really look at this mind that constantly puts ourselves down.
It's a mind that looks at the result. It's more focused on the result.
Yeah. It's focused on the result. You don't see any process. Yeah? You see the seed and you see the fruit, and you don't see the tree in between them. Yeah? So that's kind of a narrow view, isn't it? Yeah? There's always processes. Uh huh. So you have Buddha nature, but you just have an inferior Buddha nature. Okay. Well, the Buddha nature is the emptiness of inherent existence of the mind. So you think one emptiness of inherent existence is inferior to another emptiness of inherent existence?
Less empty.
Sorry, doesn't work. Yeah, that's the thing, you know, the Buddha nature, that abiding Buddha nature, is something that never changes. Yeah, it's the emptiness of inherent existence of the mind. Everybody's mind is equally empty. Yeah.
It's just a comment how this text and then Ari Dev's text, the same thing. these points are put out again and again, slightly differently, answering our question, well, could you say it a different way? It's just sort of like, okay, I get it, but. Mm-hmm. It just keeps working.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
Yeah. Coming at it from many different angles, but the same point, you know, trying to get it into our thick skulls. But here they're talking about people who really understand that view and are living it. Yeah, and their behavior is going to be good. The people who just mouth the ideas but don't live it, you know, their behavior is going to be all over the place. Oh, okay, because if you're a nihilist, then you don't believe in cause and effect, so there's no way to create the causes for awakening. Yeah. So, next verse, we'll go into next week. This gets very interesting, you know. This thing about past, present, and future, and when does it exist? So we're getting into the actual refutation of inherent existence. Okay, so we'll dedicate.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bostock's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the